in giving reflections on different people's meditation, and if people ask a particular question about meditation, there's a certain anxiety about saying something that other people will listen to and think, well, it applies to them. And then saying something that I know at some level is going to be misunderstood, because any communication involves some misunderstanding. Any communication is somehow imperfect. So in receiving the question, what was experienced was a sense of this person wants to know about the gaps and then how to maintain mindfulness in the gaps between the in-breath and out-breath. And when there's the intention to use the breath as an object of meditation and know the breath, be mindful with the breath, the gaps between the in-breath and the out-breath get longer. Is that reasonably right? So everybody else who's listening, I'm sure you're going to pick it up in the wrong way. So don't worry. And I'm sure that whatever I explain, you'll have to work with yourself to figure out how it actually works for you. Okay? So those are the sort of boundaries or the outline of how, you know, whatever I say now, that's a context in which it lies. Coffee. When I have the idea that I need to concentrate on the breath and make the breath the most important thing, then it can work. And if there's something interesting to know, then the attention will try to be more interested in it, will be more with it. When there's nothing, the attention will wander. So there's a few things about anapanasati. One of the classic books from way back doesn't translate it as mindfulness of breathing. They translate it as mindfulness with breathing, which is shifts the tone of how one approaches it. And I actually find that quite helpful, because then there's not the sense of justice, but the sense of the breath is then it's like an anchor or a reference point, something that one can use to reveal what's happening. So revealing what's happening is being less ignorant. Yeah? Practicing less ignorance and knowing something that's important, because if you're not breathing, you're in trouble, eh? So knowing something important is helpful. Not knowing something important, you're likely to make mistakes. Yeah. Like, is the door open or is it closed? Does it need to be open or does it need to be closed? Oops. And what's freeing, what's liberating, won't be the breath. Sorry. Won't be the breath. What's liberating is the Buddha, is the knowing. And that which encourages the sense of presence. And what I'm hearing you say, and I may be wrong, is that when you feel there's nothing much going on, like between an in-breath and an out-breath and an out-breath and an in-breath, you feel that the attention seems to drift. Yeah, is that right?
Sometimes,
not always. Then what I find helpful to reflect on and to come back to is that the overall intention with the meditation is a sense of well-wishing, and a sense of wishing to understand what is happening, a sense of being free from ignorance. Yes, that's the intention. So that's why you meditate, I hope. Yeah. And sustaining the sense of knowing how to do that. Now, if your knowing if that sense of knowing is really tied to knowing whether the breath is going in or going out, and the gaps don't tend to do it for you so much, then what you can always use, and what is always, the breath is helpful because you are always breathing, and it can anchor you, it can take you back, and you can't fake your breath. You can't say to yourself, "I'm breathing in when I'm breathing out." That doesn't work. it's actually happening. So you're either breathing in or you're breathing out, or there's a gap. Yeah. So, but what's important is what to return to is the Buddha, the knowing. So, to allow the breath to and the knowing of the breath, the knowing, to take you to the knowing. So the knowing of the gap, rather than trying to concentrate or make the breath the most important thing, make the Buddha the most important thing. Make the knowing the most important thing. You see what I mean? And then you're the object of concentration is less important than the knowing. And then as you're breathing here now, are you breathing? You can know whether the breath is going in or going out. And you can know the knowing. And you can stay with that much more. Does that help? And then, in terms of, sitting meditation, I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out, and there's a gap, and my mind's wandered. Don't fuss about that so much, but if you want to use that a bit, if you want to stay with that, and if you want to concentrate on the breath, I don't know what you're doing with that, when you're sitting. So I don't know what you're giving attention to when you know whether the breath is going in or going out, what sensations you're noticing or what sensations you're not noticing, or whether you're noticing the breath from here down to here or this up, whatever you're doing. But what you can also do is, you can try doing, play. I try to encourage people to play with their attention and play with what they're doing rather than, I have to do it. But make it something that you're interested in because it's interesting. So to make it interesting, be interested in the gaps. Yeah? So rather than thinking you're not paying attention to the breath because there's no breath, there's no breath, there's no breath, it's not coming in, it's not going out, I don't know what to do. Be interested in the gap itself. Yeah? And then, where are you experiencing the gap? How are you experiencing the gap? What color is it, the gap? What tone is it? What sound does it make? So there's a sense of interest in the gap, not just in, this is the breath coming in, going out. Yeah? Because then you're only interested in the breath coming in and going out. You're not interested in the gap. Yeah, so the mind goes over here because it's not interested. You've not given yourself the interest in that. But the important thing is the knowing. And that you can do as you're sitting here. Yeah, you can stay with the Buddha here. Does that help? Sorry if that was a bit long, and I'm sure that other people have misunderstood it and other people have messed it up the other way. Never mind. Any other questions? Have I scared you? So I have to ask you questions now. Who can explain the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas? sorry, that wasn't a challenge.
Is there a big interest in Buddhism in Portugal, in the Lisbon area?
Big and small are relative. I've been in Portugal now about 12 years, and the monastery is about only 25 acres. And last Pansa, there were 8 monastic monks and 2 Anagarikas. The people of Lisbon and the area were in a place called Ericeira, which is 30-40 minutes now from Lisbon by car. You can walk to the airport. There was one monk who decided to walk from the airport from the monastery. He set off at 2 o'clock. His flight was 9 o'clock. He reached the airport in time. Monks are strange. People are strange. So you can walk. It's on the airport side. You can reach the airport in a hurry in about 20 minutes, 30 minutes. That's if you're speeding. People from, and Ericeira was a fishing village, maybe the Phoenicians were there years ago, so it's been around for a long time, and it's used to tourists, and it's a world surfing area where they have the surfing championships. So being a little bit out of Lisbon and being a little bit touristy, a little bit alternative, it means that the village or the town now finds it quite easy to deal with strange people. And as you know, possession of cannabis in Portugal is not illegal. So it's quite a popular place for alternatives and people. So the monastery's open usually from about 4:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and people come from as far away as Porto, which is 3 hours drive away, for morning puja at 5 o'clock. That's very occasionally. More often, some people do come for morning puja, which is 5 to 6 sitting and then 20 minutes chanting of some sutta or something. And that's it. Some people come for that. Other people come through the day, and the monks do go an alms round. One or two go walk the 3 kilometers down to the ocean and stand outside the market for half an hour, and local people who don't necessarily come to the monastery do offer food into the bowl. And sometimes people from the monastery do go down and especially make offerings there. And the local national police are not worried by this or upset by this. They don't feel it's vagrancy or somehow disturbing the peace. We stand for about half an hour outside the market and then walk back. Sometimes we get a lift, or if it's raining a lot and we try to go on arms round, the people at the market say, "Go home! It's too wet, you'll catch the death." Then they get upset. And then if people try to offer money into our bowls, the local people at the market say, you can't do that, you have to offer food. So they're quite kind. And then the meal is about 10:30, and when we went to Portugal in 2012, one of my monk friends said, "Now set up a Google Calendar so people can sign up." So we have a Google Calendar on the site, so you can sign up to offer the Dani. And also, I said that I wasn't going to have any Anagarika from one of the other monasteries to come and stay with us, so there wouldn't be anybody to cook for us and there wouldn't be anybody to offer the food. I said to the people who invited us in 2012, "You have to arrange it. If you can't arrange the food, then we can't stay." So one of the things they did, and only one day did somebody who said they were going to come, didn't come. The monks weren't hungry. We had something from the alms round. This was when we were in Lisbon. We rented a place in Lisbon to begin with. Or they rented a place in Lisbon to rent. Then what happened? So they arranged for somebody whose sort of side business. She used to do it as a sort of for friends. She'd cook meals for people. So they arranged for this person, Rosaria, to cook meals for us. They'd pay her and she'd come and have the food prepared and then offer it. She didn't know anything about Buddhism. She had to be told how to offer and how to... And she used to prepare the meal and then would sit in the, you know, bowls, the three of us. And she'd sit in front of us with a cup of tea to make sure we enjoyed it. Herbal tea. It was fun. She still comes. She's wonderful. And so now people do come, and then some people have decided to come for 8 o'clock in the morning to come and join the morning work for some reason. I have no idea why. Some people, when they come for the morning puja, they stay on through and do some work. If they stay on through some work, then they can have some breakfast, which is about 7:15, 7 o'clock, 7:15, and then the work is through the morning, and then we have the meal at 10:30. Then in the evenings, in this morning puja and evening puja, pretty much every day. And then the evening puja is 7:30 till about 8:15, 8:30. And for that, quite a few people come. You know, there'll be as many as here, just coming and joining in 10 minutes of chanting and 30, 40 minutes of sitting meditation. No instruction. Sometimes there's instruction, sometimes there's no instruction. They just come at the end of their surfing or the end of their day doing yoga or whatever they've been doing, and then they come, because it's quite close. And then they disappear by 9 o'clock, and I don't know who they are. So that's quite fun. There's enough interest. There's enough interest. There are lots of Mendeses, and Fernandos, and De Silvas, and De Soisas. There are very few Thais and practically no singular people. But there are a few, and this year they offered the Katina, which was brilliant. They had some friends whose relative is one of the chief monks at the Temple of the Tooth in Kandy. So they arranged for a Buddha Rupa to be brought over from the Temple of the Tooth to Portugal, and they offered it. They processed it down, they came and they did it. Now they were working till 1 o'clock in the morning on the Katina, putting up lanterns and making things. Wonderful, wonderful. But, you know, so generous for the Temple of the Truth to offer to Portugal. I mean, Portugal and the Temple of the Truth do not have a good history. So, very forgiving, very, very forgiving. So we have the Buddha Rupa there now. And one of our bhikkhus is going to go and spend the Vas in Sri Lanka, because one of the other bhikkhus that we have from Amaravati, he has some friends who've set up a small hermitage, which is not so... Sri Lanka, nothing's very far from anything else. It's not like Australia. So it's not so far from Kandy. So there's a kuti there that people can stay in. So he'll probably stay there. Is that what the sort of answer you wanted?
Yes.
It's not like Australia. Not like Australia at all. Or New Zealand, where a lot of the support comes from people who are traditionally Buddhist. Most of the support has come from people who live in Portugal. Not, you know, for the first couple, 2 or 3 years, most of the support came from people within Portugal. Some of the early support came from outside the country, very early support. But then for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, most of the support came from within Portugal. people living within Portugal, not necessarily Portuguese. There are some Portuguese monks. That's why we're there. Because Ajahn Sumedho likes Portugal, and some people came from Portugal and started their monastic career at Amarawati. And so that's why the place is called Sumedharama, because their upachaya is Ajahn Sumedho. And I thought there were enough ones related to Bodhinyana, which is Nupocha's title name.
In Western world, most of the times I have seen a lot of emphasis on meditation and meditation only mostly. So the rest of the things like right intention. The rest of the Eightfold Path components are not emphasized much. I have seen a lot of people tend to go to meditation without giving much emphasis on sila or dana. But usually it's in the human qualities we can see a lot of generous people and the other things. But this is the question I have. I don't know how much Dhamma teachings we should study to have right view to start meditation. Sometimes I have seen monks also emphasizing meditation, but not about much reading.
Not much theory.
Reading theory.
People are different, and people change, and people are very strange. The whole mindfulness movement and the use of mindfulness as a mindfulness in itself doesn't lead to liberation. Mindfulness and concentration do not in themselves lead to liberation. Because as people have often said, a cat needs to be very mindful and concentrated in order to catch a mouse. There's a certain buzz that happens when you're in the zone, which is attractive for extreme sports. And a lot of mindfulness and calm is needed in order to be a sniper to shoot somebody. So in themselves, that's what it is. And I think people learn themselves. If you're here tomorrow, I think there's a day workshop thing, isn't there? Tomorrow?
Yes.
Yeah? So if you're not coming, then here's a taster. And if you are, this is the trailer. So, and what I tend to talk about, there's a couple of things that I have found helpful myself and I didn't feel were emphasized enough when I first did my first meditation retreat in 1975. The first time I sat on the floor thinking, I need to concentrate. Because I think it's because of not knowing why we're doing things. And I try to encourage myself and others to be in touch at visceral means? Visceral means internal, the visceral organs, the sort of really inside. why the heck am I doing this? Because if I don't know what that is, then, and I'm not in touch with that, then I'm not, I'm ignorant of where the energy is coming from. And what I feel is, you know, this is a theory of mine. It's not completely mine, but I feel that life seeks an optimum. The optimum condition is what life moves towards as best it possibly can. It, you know, it tries to figure out what's the best thing that I can do. It doesn't even think like a piece of grass or even a piece of weed coming up through the concrete. It doesn't think what's the best that I can do. It just tries to find the light. So, you know, the energy just tries to push through the concrete. Well, however it does, an amoeba moves away from something that irritates it and towards something that it likes. So for humans, what's the best that humans really can realize? Complete freedom from suffering. Yeah? Complete understanding of what of this whole stressful situation. Complete freedom from ignorance. So if I figure that and actually viscerally, you know, internally try to be in touch with that before I start doing any meditation. Because the tendency I've found in myself is that I can think, I'm going to meditate to get calm. I'm going to meditate to stop thinking. I'm going to meditate to feel more metta. I'm going to meditate to do this, do that, get rid of my bad habits. I'm going to do all of this. And then I don't know why I'm doing this. Why do I want to get rid of all my bad habits? Why do I want to get calm? behind all of that, it's because I wish myself well. I wish myself to be completely free from all suffering. So that's the prime thing. Forget about the rest of it. You know, I only think that it's a nuisance, my mind babbling on, because I wish myself well. So being in touch with the sense of wishing myself well, to be free from suffering, actually, deeply, before I start going, yeah, or but ho, or whatever. Yeah? So that's the first thing. And that sense of well-wishing, then, you know, the confidence that maybe there is something that I can learn from. Maybe there is some being that I can learn from. Maybe there's something that I can learn here. This is something that I can do. Yeah. Well, that impulse, which is reflected in that really simple statement, which you do many times, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. What does that mean? It means that my hero is the Buddha. I feel that there is something that I can learn from. And what's that in terms of the Eightfold Path? It's called Samaditti. Yeah? You know, that sets it up. So I don't necessarily go like that, but what I do next is, when I'm teaching these things, I talk about, you know, that what everybody can do, which overcomes the sense of inadequacy. The simplest thing that you can do if you feel inadequate, is to give. Yeah? Because in that act of giving, You cannot feel inadequate. Because if you feel inadequate, you can't give. You want to keep. Yeah. And what you're doing when you're giving is you're just letting go. And that, you know, you're giving. Now when you give, you don't want anything back. Yeah, because you know it's not a bargain. Yeah, when you give, you give. And I've now, in the last, don't know how long, not so very long, I've started to reflect on, you know what people say, what's the highest gift? Come on, it's written on all the books. The gift of Dhamma, yes? Well, who deserves the gift of Dhamma most? The person you live with all the time, come on. Give yourself the Dhamma. You know, give yourself the Dhamma. No, this is the highest gift you can give. It's not the book that you read, it's actually, you know, what is the truth here? Can you give yourself the Dhamma? And then you start to try to listen. But what is this Dhamma? How can I give myself the Dhamma? And then you start to reflect and know a bit, and then as you, well, what's happening? You know, what's the gift here? How can I give this? And then, as you all know, the five precepts is a wonderful gift. It's a gift you can give yourself, which is the gift of not having to hide anything, yeah, and being confident about what's happening. And it's also a gift that you give all beings, because you give all beings somebody they don't need to be frightened of. Yes. Because if people are not keeping the five precepts, I'm a bit wary about people who don't keep the five precepts. I'm a bit scared of them, actually. I'm not sure that I can cope with a drunkard, with somebody who's lying to me, with somebody who's out to exploit me sexually, somebody who's trying to steal from me, or somebody who's trying to hurt me. Yeah? Whereas if you can give yourself and give others the gift of the five precepts, you're doing pretty well, eh? So, you know, that, and recognizing that, and what that does is it puts you in tune with Dhamma. You know, it's something that, you know, all humans can recognize. It's something right here and now. It's something that's beautiful or inviting. It leads to a sense of relief. Isn't it a relief when you're around somebody who keeps the five precepts? You know, it's a great thing about coming to a monastery. I haven't felt, you know, I asked, should I lock my room up there? I mean, if I was in a hotel, you'd lock your room. If you're staying in a monastery, maybe not, but not necessary. I don't need to feel that these guys are going to rip me off in some way. And it's a different feeling, because I feel that they've given me the gift of Dhamma, and they're giving themselves the gift of Dhamma as well. So, you know, I talk about this sort of thing. And that sets the tone for your meditation. Yeah? Does that help a bit? So give yourself the Dhamma. It's the highest gift. And when you give yourself something, you're not asking for results. I am only going to give myself the Dhamma unless if I get calm and peaceful. You know, yeah. What you receive is what you receive. I'm only going to practice the Dhamma just so that I can get peaceful. But only because you wish yourself well. Yeah, and what you would really like is a happiness independent of conditions. A happiness dependent upon conditions is always a fragile happiness. If you're only going to be happy if your mind is peaceful, you're always going to be disappointed. Sorry. My mind's not peaceful. Mudita is a sense of appreciation of goodness and joy. Okay? Joy at goodness. And it's not wrong. Yeah, it's not wrong to appreciate joy and success. I was about 18, 19 pansas or something. 19 pansas, I think. 19 years, a monk. And I saw a couple of bhikkhus that year. One bhikkhu I saw had arrived in Kuala Lumpur, I think, in 1953, which is when I was born. And he'd eventually become what's called he was the head of the Vihara, Brickfields Vihara in Kuala Lumpur, Kesari Dhammananda. And I was talking to him and he says, you know, here I am in Kuala Lumpur. I'm proud of what I've done, you know, Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakasapa, they wouldn't have bothered with this place. He had two committees to look after, a singular committee and a Chinese Malay committee. He had a tiny little vihara in the middle of Kuala Lumpur, which he gave away some of the land for a Christian church. And what he'd done almost single-handedly was make Theravada Buddhism something that the Chinese Malays could understand and appreciate. And this has allowed the forest monks and the forest tradition to come into Malaysia in various different ways and being accepted. So he was rightly quite happy and proud of what he'd done. And I thought, that's interesting. You know, that's a good thing. And then I went to Colombo, and I went to the Vajirarama, yeah, and this man, he was at that time he was very sick, and I was staying there for a couple of days. I wanted to pay respects, so he went to Sri Lanka in 53, yeah, he was the guy who, you know his story. Do you know his story? Anyway, he spent 10 years in the island hermitage, and then after that, never more than 3 months anywhere. And when people used to, he'd lost all his passports and all his documentations. When people used to ask him, where are you going? He said, I'd find out at the end of the road when I decide whether to turn left or right. Things like that. He had nothing. And he was lying in bed. He was sick. And I went to see him. He said, and how's your practice? That's the first thing he said to me. So, and you know, two different people, and I was born in 53. So these are two different people who had led their lives up to 98 in completely different ways, two different bhikkhus, both really given themselves to the Dhamma in completely different ways, both admirable. And I just recognize that people are different. Think how things are going to work out. It's just not sure. So, you know, that's where I'm at on that one. I just think how things work out and how people are is different. And that what I had was a sense of joy that these people, so different, could still bring me joy because they were both really admirable. Yeah, in very different ways. And that's that sense of appreciation of what you've done and appreciation of others, I think is under-emphasized. And it's okay to feel that joy. You know? So appreciate the goodness of your life. And if you give something and you've let it go, say, hey, that was all right. I did a good job there. There's nothing wrong with that. You know the singular tradition of, you know, writing down all the good things of you, in the book. And then also the singular tradition of the end of the day of remembering the people who've given you support in your life. I know quite a few singular people do that. They actually, at the end of the day, they try to remember all the people who've given them support. And you think, well, that's a bit. But when you think, what did Sariputta used to do? Now, the story is that wherever Venerable Asaji was, you know, Venerable Asaji was the person who gave him his first teaching, he would bow in the direction of Venerable Asaji before he went to sleep every night, and he was already a full, you know, Sariputta was a full arahant. You know, so that sense of appreciation is okay to feel. It's a natural expression of a heart free from ignorance. And to appreciate yourself is okay. You know, to appreciate your good fortune. Here you are. You've managed to support the monastery for this time. You're part of it. You've practiced well. Okay. It's all right to feel that. You're not feeling you're a great person or anything, but you're feeling, I don't have any big regrets. It's okay. I gave that. But also in the sense of giving food and things, at least you don't watch us taking the food. In some monasteries, in some places, has he taken my food yet? How much has he taken of my food? You haven't really given it, have you? You know, there's this thing of, you know, we do this thing of offering into the hands, yes. And then if you touch it, you have to offer it again, yeah? Because when you offer it, you've given it up. If you start moving it around, you're saying, it's mine, again. I'm going to try and look after it because it's mine. Whereas if you've offered it, then let the monks look after it. It's technically not wrong to move around the food afterwards, yeah? But as a practice, it's like saying, you've given it up. Does that make sense? But it's okay to feel glad about the goodness. You know, there's one monk that I know. He gave a kidney away. You know, he voluntarily gave his kidney away. And he says, you know, when I remember that, it makes me happy. And, you know, when you remember the goodness that you've done in your life, it's okay to be happy about that. It's called mudita. Thank you.